Ron Gilbury. Today's lecture is entitled Mailer Scoring Lab and the Normalization Group.
Okay, well, I have a point today.
The label for the measures
is because of this nice convolution property. When you can log two Gaussian measures in finite or infinitely many dimensions, the new measure is also Gaussian and its covariance is the sum of the original two covariances. Next thing, a Gaussian measure defines a Laplacian by this formula. Basically, you can think of the Laplacian as an infinitesimal Gaussian integration because this formula says that for very small t means covariance is very small, and that means that the A is very, very large, so this thing becomes very close to being a delta function. And convolution by a delta function is almost the identity. So really what this says is that convolution by a Gaussian measure is the identity plus a small correction, which is linear, just as the plus. That's a way of defining the Laplacian in infinitely many dimensions. And if you look at how it acts on a function of just finite with many variables, then it acts like a normal Laplacian would, except that you've got this set of coefficients, the covariance in there as well. So C sub ij would be this matrix here, and D sub I would be partial differentiation with respect to the x out variable. Then, it's a formula which is the most convenient way of knowing how to work out the moments of a Gaussian measure. If you can involve a polynomial by a Gaussian, it's the same as acting by the exponential of a Laplacian. And we can define the exponential of a Laplacian simply by expanding the exponential, since it's acting on a polynomial. This infinite expansion will terminate after one or too many terms. That gives a nice formula, even if it's set by 0, so that instead of getting a convolution to an integral, that's a nice formula for the moments in the Gaussian measure. Now, those are the basic facts, and on top of that, we can build quite a nice little edifice. That's basically what physicists know about Gaussian measures. Wrote it down. And here's the beginning of this little edifice. I'm going to work with just one dimension. So capital AD1 means that I've got a one-dimensional Gaussian measure, on just the real line. Last time, in colloquium, I was talking about complex Gaussian measures, and I've just gone to real ones just for simplicity. But everything I do Gaussian measures on complex variables. Everything I'm doing for these real ones has a natural analog of the complex ones. So this is what I want to do. I'm going to define a number by doing this stupid little integral at the interval of many variables. I can do that integral. It's just that I don't want to tell you what the answer is because we don't need to know the answer for what I'm doing next. Better to know the material this way. Now, of course, if you define numbers that way, then they will add by just putting the intervals together. The interval A to B, the interval B to C. I'm assuming, well, that they're disjoint, and they were just combining the intervals, so these numbers will combine by that sort of formula there. So then, the corresponding Gaussian measures. This is the one that has the mu sub AB is a Gaussian measure which has that as its covariance. Those two Gaussian measures, where you involve them together, the intervals will just combine like that. And then the next thing to do is to define a scaling operator. So here's the parameter t, which is I'm going to scale by the exponential of minus t, so I just take a function f of phi, and I make a new function out of it by multiplying phi by minus t, scaling by t. And lastly, we put the two operations together. I'm quite ready for that yet. We have this intertwining relationship between convolution and scaling. If you scale first and then convolve by a Gaussian measure, that's the same thing as scaling second, but convolving first by a different Gaussian measure. And you see, this is the reason why I want an exponential in that integral there. Because there's a nice exponential in that integral there, when you work it out, the scaling simply moves the interval along by t, which translates it by t. So just keep this in mind, because I'm going to use this on the next couple of slides. Every time I move a scaling past one of these Gaussian convolutions, I simply change the covariance to another covariance, which is gotten from the original one by just moving the interval of integration. Well, once you've got that, then we can define a very nice combination. Let's see how it fits this. This is a T sub T is an operator that acts on functions, nice functions, and it acts by first convolving by the Gaussian measure and then scaling up. And it's a semi-proof, and the proof is very trivial. Here it is. The basic operation in the proof is that when you write down the definition of these two T's, you have a scaling and a convolution, a scaling and a convolution. You move the scaling past the convolution. So the pink arguments passed are there, and as it does so, it of course changes the interval. But that's exactly the way it changes the interval, is exactly right to add onto this one, so that you get a new Gaussian measure with S plus T there, and a new scaling, because these two scalings combine into one, and that's the new operator. Now, if we differentiate, then the next thing is that being a semigroup, we expect to be able to write it as the exponential of some differential operator. It's an exponential sum operator, and then we find that operator by differentiating the spectrum T, and I'm going to write it this way, because this is in fact how it makes good sense in infinitely many dimensions. There's a Laplacian, and there's a derivative of the scaling. That's the derivative of the scaling. So we have... and so the end of this one-dimensional development is like this. We've established that this combination, which I call T sub T, which is Gaussian convolution followed by scaling, is the exponential of a certain operator, which is called the Hermite operator. And, writing an exponential, one can equivalently write a differential equation. You can say that this partial differential equation, derivative of f with respect to t, equals this Hermite operator acting on f, is solved by f equals exponential of Hermite operator. We know that the exponential is this combination of scaling and Gaussian convolution. And this is Naylor's formula, except that if you look up in the books, you'll usually find something unitarily equivalent to this rather than this formula. Now, we can carry on with this development. The Hermite operator, which appeared on the previous slide, is associated with things called Hermite polynomials. And this is the way the theoretical physicists would like to view these things. The definition I'm giving there, it's phi to the n with these colons around it. That just means a polynomial. This is a polynomial in phi of degree n. And it is a Hermite polynomial, as you would look it up in the books, except for a factor of 2 to the n over 2, something like that. It's up to normalization, it's exactly a Hermite polynomial. And it's defined by letting one of these exponentials of the Laplacian act on phi n. And you see, the subscript 0 infinity, what this means is... You remember that if I have a Gaussian measure with the interval 0 infinity defining its covariance, if I convolve that onto a function and I put a factor, this is funny what I really meant here, it's better if I write it this way, t c sub the, I remember that this, every Gaussian measure defines the Laplacian. So that's what I mean by that Laplacian that appears there. It's the one that's associated with convolution by this Gaussian measure with covariance to construct the mean equals 0 to infinity. So this is how I want to define it. So we could compute right away if we wanted to what the polynomial, say, of y squared is. Nice thing to do. These colons in the physics of the derivative is weak order. So it's called weak order of y squared. So how many colons? It would be e to the minus Laplacian 0 to infinity, anti-norm phi squared, and this would be 1 minus 1 half Laplacian 0 to infinity, anti-norm phi squared. No need to go any further with the expansion of the exponential because you can only differentiate this twice before you get 0, and that would give you phi squared minus 1 half, and then there'll be another factor of 2 because of this Laplacian epsilon on phi squared, and we will have c 0 to infinity. So, not what you can give you, and that will give you the up to this factor of 2 of a half or something that will give you another polynomial of order 2. Now, the nice reason for defining it this way is it's immediate to show that it's an eigenfunction of this semi group t sub t, the Hermite semi group. And I won't go over it, but you can see it's pretty fast. That's proof. Oh, another thing before I leave it. Another thing you can see, and this kind of explains the notation, you can see that d by d phi, the weak order phi to the n, is n, weak order phi to the n minus 1, which is an analog of a well-known formula for Hermite polynomials of scientific normalization. You can see that because you can move the d by d phi past the expansion of the plus. That explains, of course, why it's thought of as a power. Now, throughout this talk, there are no infinite numbers. Sometimes people see these in the physics course, and it means that some infinite subtractions have taken place, but there are no infinite numbers in any of this. Even when I reach infinite dimensions, there won't be any infinite numbers. These definitions are only generate finite objects. The last property that want to discuss here in this one-dimensional context is that the Hermite polynomial and this measure, Gaussian measure constructed through this covariance from 0 to 13, well, that's an invariant measure. This is very easy to prove. In fact, this is a slightly more general formula, which is the one I want to emphasize a bit more, actually, which is that if you don't go from 0 to infinity, but just go from 0 to t, take a smaller covariance, then the Hermite polynomial acting on f kind of does some of the integration for you, because that's a smaller covariance there. That's the covariance constructed on the shorter interval and the covariance constructed there. So there's less, the smaller the covariance gets, the smaller the less integration you have to do. It's the closer the integration is to being a delta function. So in a way, doing this on a function is actually doing part of that integral talk in this formula. Kind of method of gradual integration. Of course, more standard way of saying it is that you could do this integral here by simply taking t sub t and f to the equivalent t goes to infinity, t sub t acting on f. Because you need graphs there. Right, now, let's take a look at one-dimensional version of first-order perturbation theory here. So, In the physics literature, something called the Wilson renormalization, and it's a method of gradual integration based on this idea I was just talking about a moment ago. If you want to do a Gaussian integral with covariance 0 to t for some function that I choose to write in for e to the minus t, then I can do a smaller Gaussian integration onto a smaller covariance, but t sub t acting on e to the minus t instead. You see, as little t gets to, as little t approaches capital T, that just become a delta function. So basically, if I can just let little t here approach capital T, I'll become that logarithmic. So it's a kind of gradual, it's a way of gradually integrating out. That's a good thing to do when the covariance is very, very large, as will be the case in a moment when we talk about infinitely many dimensions. You don't want to do infinitely many integrals all at once, that can give you a headache. But if you just do them one at a time, it's a little bit, that's better. So, then the next thing is, just notation. Call this thing t sub t e to the minus t, just call it e to the minus w, so that actually depends on t that w. So I just went right to it. This is called the effective interaction, this w. It's the interaction, V is called the interaction, for reasons that I don't want to go into now, but when you do a little bit of Gaussian integration, it becomes a new interaction, and that's called the effective interaction. So then the gradual integration formula simply means that I do less of a Gaussian integral, and I have a more complicated interaction than I had before. That's the renormalization group, or at least as much of it as you can find surviving in one dimension. It's G sub t. I'll come back and explain that remark a bit more in a moment, but let's take a look now at, let's just calculate a little bit. So suppose that the V that I started with was just some number lambda, which has to be positive, times this Hermite polynomial, which we call it 5.4. Now, t sub t down here is not quite the same as a t sub t up there, but they are the same if you neglect terms of order b squared with some form of expansion in powers of b. Then they're the same. Which is what, so I want to calculate all of these squared and neglect everything else, just for a moment. And then, of course, the calculation is really easy, because once the t sub t is up there, it acts on this 5 to the 4th, and we know that the 5 to the 4th, we order being a Hermite polynomial, we know that it's a eigenfunction. Since it's an eigenfunction, t sub t will simply act on it, and e to the minus 4t is the way in which it acts. So, what we're saying here is that if you started off with a very small v, so that for some reason you could neglect all the v squared terms, well, I think it should be all the v squared there rather than v. I'll change that. Order v squared. If you neglect this order v squared, then the integration, this gradual integration procedure, is really very, very simple. It just changes the coupling constant, lambda, to a multiple of what it was before. This gives you a glimpse of what are called effective coupling axes. Now, it does a bit more than that in most cases, because usually you won't be so lucky as to have an eigenfunction of t sub t on the x-axis. You'll have some more general function. So suppose you had a 5 to the 4th up there, which wasn't a Hermite polynomial. Well, then you could do the same calculation very easily. Again, I'm calculating more b squared, so I'm taking a t sub t up into the exponent, like I did again. And well, the bottom line of the calculation is that you'll get e to the minus 4t times 5 to the 4th, which is kind of what I had before, but you'll also get some other terms, pi squared and a constant. There are two ways you can think of this. One is that you have to take the finite pool and expand it in terms of eigenfunctions, then let the TCT act on the eigenfunctions and then put them back in terms of finite, in terms of polynomials. Or you can just simply use the definition and let that act, then this is the definition of TCT, and then that on finite pool. You can get that formula back. For example, this covariance comes about because one of the passing acted on finite pool, reducing it from pi squared, and then there is the covariance. So, the reason I'm putting this up here is because it shows you that gradual integration will transform whatever you start with, if it's just a polynomial, into another polynomial. So besides the coupling constant, lambda, changing, you see, lambda become lambda minus 4t, some other characters will enter the game, multiples of phi squared and multiples of constants, and they will have their own coupling constants in front of them too. Now, I've neglected the v squared, but if I were to put the v squared in there, we'll get to that at the end of the lecture, well, then you have even more corrections. You have a slightly different number there, slightly different numbers here, and you also, of course, wouldn't simply remain with finally 4 phi squared and a constant. You could have much more complicated things like phi 6. In fact, it's a function, the function you get doesn't actually have the convergent expansion of powers of 5. It's a complicated function of 5. Now let's take a look at infinitely many dimensions. At the moment, it's best if you just understand the underlying algebraic structure. Don't worry too much about function spaces and other things. I'll finish those at the end of the last lecture. But suppose we've now got a continuum of Gaussian variables, phi sub x. Now I'll let the scaling act on phi sub x. Like we did before, there's a new parameter here, which is this brackets of phi. That's just a number, and I'm going to call that the dimension of phi. And I'll tell you how to choose that in a moment. So there's some number we put there. It was 1 before, for the one dimension case. But the other thing the scaling does is it moves the x. See, scaling acts nicely on r to the d. You could, in fact, do something like this with any group that acts on r to the d, but the scaling seems to work out nicely. And so we simultaneously scale the x and scale the phi. Then now, covariance, of course, is an integral of 2 phi, so it should, on dimensional analysis grounds, have some scaling as if it was made up of 2 phi. And so we'll make this definition that it scales down by a weight of 2 times this parameter phi times t, and both x and y in the covariance scale. Remember that covariance is going to be a function of x and y now. We've got some continuum variables. And then, in close analogy to what I did before, I will consider Gaussian integrals, Gaussian measures with very special covariances. These covariances will be constructed by taking your favorite function, c dot. Just pick any function you like. It has to be positive definite. And I would like it to be rapidly decaying. I'd actually even like it to be compactly supported. But at least rapidly decaying and smooth. A really nice function. Then, scale it by this law and integrate over all scales in some integral domain. Lots of functions can be written this way. Well, I'll show you on the next slide what that really means about the covariances. It's these covariances that I want to consider, and so there's a very special class of Gaussian measures. How do we choose this parameter phi, which is two-dimensional? feel fine. Okay, now if you integrate, if you just take a function and integrate it over all scalings, then if the integral converges, what you should get is a scaling derivative function. So, integrating over all scalings means I want to do the integral that I was talking about, and I have to go from minus infinity to infinity. I want to take a to be minus infinity, b to be plus infinity. I integrate over all scalings that way. Get a scalar invariant function. And scalar invariant functions are things like logarithms and powers of x minus y. And if I choose the phi not to be zero, this is the type of function we get. We get x minus y, homogeneous function, x minus y. So that's what you would, those are the kinds of functions that you can represent as an integral of scalings of one function from minus infinity to infinity. Now, if you only do some of the integral, some of the scalings, like for example, if you just integrate over scalings from 0 to infinity instead, then you will get a function that's trying to be scaling there into 1n, namely when x minus y is very, very large. We're integrating over scalings by big numbers, so you you get, intuitively reasonable, you should get a function that has a scaling behavior for x minus y large. And the scaling behavior is this. This is why I call it the this phi appears here. In terms of the scaling behavior, the behavior looks like this choice makes If you do the integral over minus infinity to zero for scalings, then you'll get a function whose short distance behavior is x minus y goes to zero, is homogeneous. So, this gives us an idea of how to choose phi in order to be dealing with, say, self-avoiding walk. Now, the point is that that self-avoiding walk problem, the four dimensions that I talked about last time, isn't solved yet. And this isn't going to solve it, because the Gaussian measures that I had there were Gaussian measures on a lattice, whereas these are Gaussian measures on a continuum of variables, Rd, and I can have exact scaling behavior in the present context, which makes all the formulas beautifully simple and everything work really well, whereas we'd have to work a bit harder to be dealing with the Gaussian measures I had last time. So, I mean, this is actually one of the minor obstacles in the way of doing what I want to do for self-avoiding walk. But there's a nice theory here, and you can get an idea of how to apply to self-avoiding walk by saying, well, take a look at the Gaussian measures which you're interested in the context of self-avoiding walk. You don't remember what those are, but if you went back and looked at them, you would discover that they have a covariance which looks like the potential for simple random walk on a lattice. And the potential for simple random walk on a, in fact, doesn't look like it is the potential for simple random walk on a lattice. That potential, the zero potential, falls off in four dimensions like 1 over x minus y squared. And in d dimensions, in this way here, 2 minus capital D, except that D equals 2. I want to talk about four or more dimensions here. So this is how I choose the scaling. It's called the canonical dimension. Throughout theoretical physics, this is the typical choice for the scaling in phi, because it leads to Gaussian measures that are connected with other classes. So that's a choice I shall make. And then we can take a look again at what first order perturbation theory is now going to look like in infinitely many dimensions. And by first order perturbation theory, I simply meant that stupid business of taking the operator t sub t, which is acting on an exponential, and putting it up in the exponential. So we have this gradual integration formula, that's just the same as it was before. Everything, all the properties I proved in the one-dimensional case, they slide over to the infinite-dimensional case in the way you'd expect. We still have weak polynomials which are, in certain sense, eigenfunctions. things like that. We'll see in a moment. So, here's the gradual integration formula. Let's take the V now to be like it was before, a 5 to the 4th, only because we now have a continuum of variables, we can do something else. We can put in this integral there. That's a nice thing to do because that's a multiplicative functional, e to the minus, well, that's an additive functional, and e to the minus is an additive functional, it's multiplicative. So those are the kinds of perturbations that physicists like, and probably do. They preserve, if you have some type of Markov properties, the underlying Gaussian measure, they preserve them. Anyway, those are this is the typical type of interaction on what's computer physics, and it's also the one we want in the self-avoiding warp problem. Self-avoiding warp problem was that we had Gaussian measure that looked like this. And the self-avoiding warp puts in something like this. Where tau is pi bar plus d pi pi bar over 2 pi r. Now, there's the Gaussian part, and then this tau gives the square of this, so it involves the square of the pi bar. Also involves the square of this form part, which would be a new thing to deal with in the context of self-avoiding warp. But not one that will scare Joel, because those are fermions, and he's the world's leading expert on fermions, so he knows that there's no big deal with that. So, this time around, if we now let the T sub T act, things are pretty much the way they were before. For instance, e to the 4t looks, things are not that way, so we're going to sign that. E to the minus would be better. Okay. The e to the minus 4t kind of reminds us of what we saw before. That's the scaling of the phi by e to the minus 2 or something like that. That's actually the right scale for this. It's four dimensions. That's right. But then there's something new, which is this capital D here. And that, of course, came from the fact that the x scales, because remember we scale the x. So we have something new there. And so now we see something that's actually very positive because when I first thought about it, you see the Hermite semigroup is the exponential of a positive operator, so the spectrum begins at zero, right? But this number here can be exponentially growing. It would be if d is less than 4. So it looks like somehow in infinitely many dimensions we might be getting into a situation where somehow the Hermite operator has forgotten that its spectrum is bound below. How can that be? Well, in fact, it's not exactly an eigen function anymore, because you see, you started off with that volume, and you've ended up with a different volume. The only way it could become an eigen function is if you could somehow formulate this in an infinite volume. So then all bets are off. It's good to remember that there are now things that grow exponentially, like demons.
The way with that minus sign you're at, it grows exponentially when d is greater than 4.
So did I screw that up again? Let me think about this. Yes, I shouldn't have added the minus sign. Okay, how do you cross out something that's good? Yeah, well, that was right, because it was before. Thanks, Gordon. Okay, so if d is less than 4, it grows. And if d is 4, it's a little hint of the role of dimension here, then it can't quite make up its mind what to do. he is bigger than Paul. So somebody asked me last time why self-avoiding walk doesn't seem to know it has an interaction in more than four dimensions. There's a little hint. So now, let's go back and we're in the infinite dimensional situation. Take a view which is a bit more general, just a polynomial, a pi to the fourth part, a pi squared part, and a constant part, even the polynomial which is quarter. Let's just keep working in first order in perturbation theory. So t of e to the minus t is e to the minus t of e still. Then you find that the renormalization group, namely applying t sub t, is equivalent to a deformation of this polynomial where the coefficients of the polynomial just change according to, and I've written them as differential equations, but it's the same exponential laws as I had before, if you actually integrate those differential equations. I'm just writing them in this way to get ready for what happens in second order. You find that the lambda is a coupling constant that will exponentially decay if the dimension is bigger than 4, and will exponentially grow if the dimension is less than 4. You find that the beta, the number in front of there, no matter what dimension you're in, always grows exponentially with an eigenvalue 2. And you find that the gamma, the constant part, always grows with an eigenvalue d, which is the dimension of space. And that's the most you can extract out of first order perturbation theory, but of course, now you have to worry, is first order perturbation theory even, let alone whether we can actually prove real estimates and so on, is it even in the sense of theoretical physics an intelligent thing to be trying to do? And that depends, of course, on whether or not the coupling constant lambda and the beta are small. Because if they're not small, then we shouldn't be doing things this way. So there is a criterion we would expect, which is that this is only a good guide to what's going on as long as those numbers, lambda and beta, remain small. Now, I put in this bullshit here. More detailed analysis shows that including d squared does not qualitatively change the slope of t such that lambda and beta remain small. It's a d greater than 4. Well, okay, I'm afraid I don't actually know of a place where I can give a reference to that. It's kind of secret knowledge that everybody in constructive field theory has, but not anywhere written as far as I'm aware. Okay. I think that's actually one of the troubles with constructive field theory, is there's a vast quantity of secret knowledge, but there isn't very many easy places to find it written out in a way that would be appealing to newcomers. How long do I want to integrate these differential equations into the future? Well, remember that the lambda, the total volume of the interaction, has a tendency to shrink. There's a scaling factor. That's making it smaller. Now, a critical aspect of what we're trying to do here is to come up with ways of doing these integrals, or approximating these integrals, which are uniform in the size of the volume. So, we're going to need to be able to, if you want to work with a very, very large volume, you really want to let the t run. You want to do this gradual integration so you can reduce the volume down to a unit cube. That's basically, it gives you an idea of a time scale in which you've got a solid force. So, that's why I say here, let's define capital T, which is the time I want to run differential equations forward to, by this criteria, that at the time capital T, the volume is shrunk to a volume of 1. The volume of interaction. Now, here's the deal. If under the true exact evolution, whatever that may be, if you can keep the lambda related small for that time from 0 to t, then The gradual integration formula gives you a unit volume interaction here with a small number in front of it. And basically, only the constant part of the interaction is really going to give you much of a contribution. The other things are very small. That's the idea. So really, this is the rough idea of how we're going to evaluate this integral. Do the gradual integration exactly if you can to all orders. Run it until the volume is shrunk to all of one, and then the constant is basically all that counts. The constant, by the way, can grow as much as it likes. That doesn't affect anything. It's only the Langmuir beta that is too small. The constant, in fact, are probably interesting. When am I supposed to stop?
Then are you keep going for
another 7 minutes?
Yeah, 10 minutes, I think.
For 7 minutes? Okay, yes. I can stop actually pretty soon. Right, now, so generically, now the beta, remember, was growing exponentially. At least that's the term in this differential equation, wants to make it grow exponentially. So it won't grow. It won't stay small, normally. So if you just randomly pick an initial beta and start this procedure, it will get larger and larger. And then this sentence comes into play. It basically takes over. I mean, this is the result of very long analysis. It takes over, actually a very long analysis and also a very short analysis, because there's this fantastic theorem here that takes like 5 or 6 lines to prove, which gives you the same result. But if you do it the way I'm explaining, it's a very long analysis. But it takes over, and you're in the, for those who know what it means, the state of memory is likewise. Now, here's the thing I want to concentrate on. If you're in dimension bigger than 4, then for every sufficiently small initial choice of lambda, there's a unique initial beta that you can find with the property that the lambda beta trajectory always remains small. This is including all the other, all the b squares and everything else as well. If you have that situation, then you can integrate on and on, and basically what this is doing, this argument, is proving that the scaling unit of those conserved Gaussian measures, scaling unit means to stay the uniform in the volume of the interaction, are going to match this Gaussian. And then by some completely different method that's been proved by Eisenman and Froehlich. There's also, that's, glimpse of why it's true in this context, though. I don't think it's anywhere it's really written about. Now, let's go to 4 dimensions. Oh, what is the beta in the case of the self-avoiding walk? The beta is actually the killing rate of the self-avoiding walk. And when you introduce a self-avoiding interaction, you start to kill some walks. They kill each other because they land on top of it. They kill themselves because they land on top of it. You have to adjust the beta very, very carefully in order to avoid that effect taking over. But d equals 4, the first order flow of the lambda is 0, doesn't change. But if you calculate the second order, you find that there's another coefficient that comes in. And the wonderful thing is there's a minus sign there. You have to calculate it to find it. And then you find by solving that differential equation, the lambda wants to go to 0. And then there are places you can read about this, maybe not in this quite the way I've explained it, but you could look at this right here. Now let me just finish off with just discussing the second law of perturbation theory. It's easy to derive. Way I've been doing things. The exponentially effective interaction is obtained by letting this T sub T act. And T sub T acting is the same as solving a differential equation. That's many slides back now, but that was the content of Mayer's formula. So we get this differential equation. The differential equation, if written for W, gives you a nonlinear equation. Something like cold transfer. It's converted to an integral equation. It's like an ordinary differential equation in theory, not really converted to an integral equation. Iterate, you get a big long series. Looks like
there's going to be a class at 4:30.
All right, sorry. So there it is. that's the second order, and you dig the lambda squared correction out of that. That's the end.
Okay. Thank you.
We have time for a quick question. If there is one. If not, then the third lecture in the series is in this room on Thursday at 4. No, on next Tuesday at the same time.
A week from today.